Let's get the local view. He's the columnist for the Register Guard. You can find his work on the cover of the sports section. Catch up using registerguard.com. Follow on Twitter. Use the handle at AustinMeekRG. Austin, always appreciate you starting us on a Tuesday. How's it going?
Hey, Steve. It's going good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. So the story today is obviously the passing of Pat Summitt. To call her just the Tennessee coach or just cite what she accomplished feels a little shallow as sports fans, people who work in the industry. You know, you have your favorite teams. Is it safe to say she not only transcendent, but for many years to most outside the game of women's college basketball, really the most recognizable name or the face of the sport?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And, you know, we should point out that as two men, we are probably not the most qualified ones to discuss Pat Summitt's legacy. I'd like to think we're two fairly open-minded, well-educated, insightful men, but maybe not the best perspective that we have on Pat Summitt. But, you know, one of her great contributions, though, is the fact that she really did break through gender barriers. She elevated women's basketball from being just a sport for women to being a sport for everybody. And, you know, the fact that we cover women's basketball, that women's basketball at the U of O is a big deal, it's a big deal at Oregon State, you can trace that directly to Pat Summitt. And I think, you know, even with what Gino Auriemma has accomplished at UConn, I think Pat Summitt still will go down as certainly the greatest coach in women's basketball history and one of the small handful of really groundbreaking coaches in any sport, not just because of the success and the wins and the championships, but she really made the game of women's college basketball what it is today.
Yeah, for those not aware, I mean, when she took over in 1974, women's basketball at the collegiate level wasn't even recognized in essence. So where it is now, 20 years of the WNBA, Final Four sold out, arenas sold out, is it logical to think that if she kind of got into coaching 1 or 2 years and then said, this isn't for me, that maybe the game would have grown and progressed, but not as fast without her?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think women's basketball was on a path toward what it's become. Certainly Title IX was a big factor in that. And you look at other women's sports on college campuses, softball has grown, track and field, soccer, you know,
sure.
Women's sports in general have grown over this time period. But in terms of collegiate sports, I think women's basketball is on an even higher level than the others, has grown to a level that the other women's sports are aspiring to. And, you know, it's possible to criticize women's basketball. You know, with the UConn thing, there were a lot of voices about how UConn has gotten so far ahead of the other schools. And, you know, maybe the level of play isn't that good if UConn is dominating the game that way. And, you know, maybe it's a sign that women's basketball really hasn't made that much progress. I think there's a place to have that discussion. But you got to keep in mind, you know, where this sport was, like you said, when at the time Pat Summitt became a head coach to where it is now. You know, men's sports had a really significant head start. Men's college basketball, college football, those sports have been around a long time, have had a long time to build up their audience. And is women's basketball as popular as men's basketball? Obviously not. But it's made a tremendous amount of growth in a fairly short amount of time. And I think the pace of that growth and the way the game has grown really does owe a lot to Pat Summitt.
We're talking with Austin Meek of the Register Guard. So on Sunday, you wrote a piece. I'll be honest, I did not know Dan Fouts and his family went through that horror of losing a child to cancer. Nick Fouts, as you wrote, passed in 2012. Kind of curious as to this, how this story surfaced now and the Hall of Fame quarterback and former Duck, you know, now all of a sudden willing to talk about it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were like that. They knew Dan Fouts as the great former Oregon quarterback, the Pro Football Hall of Famer, certainly the face and the voice on TV and radio, but didn't know that his family had gone through this, losing a son who was in his 30s to colon cancer in 2012. I get the impression that Dan's a fairly private person, that he doesn't talk a lot about his personal life. But his family really has taken the mantle to try to bring some good from this and to try to help other families that might be going through this. You know, when you're dealing with cancer or when a family member's dealing with cancer, there's a lot that goes into that beyond just what the health insurance covers.
Sure.
Whether it's family traveling to be close to the person who's sick, or whether you choose to pursue treatments that maybe are not covered by insurance. I mean, it's a very expensive fight to go through. And so that's what the Fouts family has tried to help with, is to raise money to help those other families and have a golf tournament and do some other fundraising types of things. So, I think it was a way for them to get the word out a little bit, and a way for them to let other families know that, hey, if you're going through this, there are people out there who can help you.
So from what I understand, what's the name of the foundation? And it's his sister, Dan's daughter, who's running it.
Yeah. Her name's Suzanne Kruger. It's Nick's sister and Dan's daughter. It's the Dominic Fouts Memorial Cancer Fund. They had their big tournament Monday at Tokatee. It sounds like it's a very bare bones operation. It's not one of those charities, where they have 50 employees and they, spend
right.
millions of dollars to raise millions of dollars. It's like, they have her, she runs it by herself. It's all volunteers, and they try to give back as much as they can of the profits to actually go to the people they're helping. So, it sounds like a really neat organization, and I know they're really working hard to raise some money.
Yeah, for anybody that missed it, it was in Sunday's paper. You can go to registerguard.com, archive it, or just scroll through Austin's Twitter feed at AustinMeekRG. So without giving it away, want to move to something a little more pleasant. You have a column pending. So you recently umpired a kids' sports game. And while I commend those who do stuff like this, my two questions would be, why and what was the experience like?
Well, to your first question, I guess the only answer is that I'm a glutton for punishment. I had actually had some experience umpiring when I was a kid. And I'll be honest, it was a really traumatic experience. I have really bad memories of it. It's kind of the classic nightmare scenario if you're an umpire. I had no training. I was like a 13-year-old kid. They'd put anybody behind the plate for these little league games. And so it's like bases loaded, close game, late innings. Kid hits a little pop-up on the infield. the kid's camped out under it, getting ready to catch it, and then the runner from first base just plows him over. Just completely runs him down. And I had no idea what to call. So the fans are on me and the coaches are screaming at me. And I was just like scarred for life by that. And so I at that time I just said, hey, I'm done with this. I turned in my gear. It's not worth the $15 or whatever I was getting paid. It's always kind of stuck with me, and I've thought about it. And I sort of got the urge that maybe I should go back and do this again and see if it's as bad as I remember it. And if it's not, then I'll be able to conquer my fear. And if it is as bad as I remember it, then it'll be kind of a funny column. That was the genesis of the idea. So last week I went out and I did it. I umpired a kids' sports game. I will have the details in a column that's forthcoming in the next day or two. But I will say it was not as traumatic as what I remembered. We had a few mishaps. I was sweating on a couple calls, but not as bad as I remember.
But the obvious question is, did you run into any of them? The parents or the grandfather or uncle who's living vicariously through their young child and is actually mouthing off at the official?
Well, see, that is a great question, because that person is the person that all umpires are looking out for. And to be totally honest, it's a problem with youth sports. I talked to several umpires and you know people at Kids Sports about just you know what's it like to be an umpire, you know, how do people deal with that? And what I heard back was it is a problem, and it's sometimes it's the coaches, once in a while it's the players, the vast majority of the time it's the parents who you know feel like they paid a registration fee for their kid to play, and that entitles them to pop off at the umpire. And it's a reason why a lot of people don't stick with it. You know, I heard a stat that 40% of the new umpires quit after a few games. They can't deal with the abuse that they get from the fans. And it's just, you know, I will say the fans were great to me. Nobody heckled me. I don't know if they knew, if maybe word had gotten back to them that, hey, we've got a guy from the newspaper working the plate today, so maybe keep your thoughts to yourself tonight. But the parents were fine for me. But what I heard from some other umpires is that the parents really can be a problem, and it makes you wonder where the priorities are with some people in youth sports, if that's really a big issue.
Ugh, it's actually distressing. Let's finish with a little peek ahead. You were not here in 2012, but once again, the Olympic trials are set for Eugene, the 1st through the 10th. From, you know, the Ducks that are in the mix to some of the events or stories, what are you looking forward to?
Well, this will be my first one. And I'm pretty excited. You know, when we talk next week, we'll see how I'm doing. I'm also looking at like 10 straight days of track columns, which, you know, I'm going to feel like I just ran the 10,000 meters, I think, by the time this thing is over. But I'm really excited for it. It's like, you know, to be able to do an event this scale in a community this size, not many places have that opportunity. So I'm fired up for it. You know, I think the thing everybody wonders going into the trials is what's going to be the moment. You know, what's going to be the thing that everybody remembers from these trials? In 2012, you had Ashton Eaton and the world record. I think that's the thing that people remember. In 2008, you had that great 800 meter final when you had three Oregon guys finishing 1, 2, 3. Christian Smith, who's actually from Kansas originally, a guy I knew way back in the day, diving across the finish line in that 800-meter final. So what's going to be the event like that this year? And there's a lot of possibilities. You know, again, a ton of people with Oregon connections in the field, so a lot of opportunities for somebody to have that signature moment. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm fired up for it. It's going to be a lot of work, but it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, here's hoping that we can't tie things together and the story won't be like the officials with the dead heat of Allison Felix and Geneva, what was her name, Tarmo. So we wish you luck. I remember we talked a couple weeks ago. You said you never thought you'd write so many articles about golf. This time it'll be same sentence, just substitute track and field for golf.
I'm really broadening my horizons here, aren't I?
You sure are. Hey, I went last time and time before. It's an awesome experience. I'm really glad you're going to get to experience it yourself. So thanks for getting us started, and I look forward to what you're going to have to say about it, Austin. Thanks a lot.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, take it easy.